boogie time. If I don't make it, I'll just quit at 5. But if we make it, this will be the shortest I have ever done on 8 and 9. I've kind of done a little preliminary on 8 and 9 with their criticality. But you know what, we laid up with the inventory, and that, of course, you know, that goes along a lot further than that. That's just one little peek at something. And when we get that decision made, 6 and 7, then we move right into some action. And like I said, a lot of people skip around this and go another direction. But for those of us who stay, some serious work gets ready to happen. And I tell you what I believe is, if I don't deal with the defects of character and the damages that I did, I'm never going to be free in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, what it says, what we're trying to do here is become happy, joyous, and free. And I really don't believe we become free, because those harms and the wrongs that we did to people don't go away. I mean, they don't disappear or die of old age. They stay there. And I believe that they don't just stay there, but they can get worse. And if we don't deal with them, I believe they become an anchor that we drag in recovery. And fail to get that freedom that comes from making things right with people, so you can look the world in the eye and take a rightful place. Now, I mentioned getting a chance to meet Bill Wilson. And now, we weren't fishing buddies or anything like that. But I went to my first international in Toronto in 65. And my primary motivation, well, I couldn't afford it by any means, but I just felt like it might be my last chance to see him. And for some reason, it was important to me to just make contact. I just wanted to, I guess, affirm that he was there, you know, that he was really a person, that, and get a chance to just be in his presence. And so he was all over the place. There was no problem being in his presence. The only problem was it was usually a ton of, I've got to watch the deal here. It was usually a ton of people wherever he was. And most of the time it was in the big arena. But one day we had a meeting on what we were just talking about, traditions. And as a rule, even with Bill Wilson, that's a little bit like announcing a fire drill or something, you know, that folks just tend to thin out. And so we wound up with a small, very select crowd, you know, really fine people, me and a few others that were good folks. And so we had the intimacy that we were looking for with this small little gathering. And Bill was talking about traditions, but he was also talking about this whole business of being free. And he was really talking about anonymity at the time, but he was talking about that AA was never intended to be some furtive hiding place for alcoholics. It never was intended to be a subterranean society that where we sort of hide in fear and all this kind of stuff. That we get the kind of privacy we need to work out things. But he said the real objective of the program is to restore us to our rightful place in society, and that these steps will do that. And he was particularly talking about 8 and 9, about this thing of making amends. And he what he said, I remember very well, was he said, if you take the actions laid out in these steps, you'll reach a point where you'll be able to walk the face of this earth and look any person you meet in the eye. Now, that sounded like a fairy tale to me. I mean, good God, I had so many devils chasing me. And that just sounded like almost like pablum stuff, but it was a picture that he painted. He said, there'll come a time that you'll be able to say to anybody, ask me anything you would like. My life's an open book. And I'll tell you, you can call that whatever you want to, but I call that freedom. That is real freedom. And what he said was absolutely true. I don't know of any place on this planet right now that I can go and be uncomfortable with anybody that I meet. Freedom. And I'd say to you, you know, we'll be here for a little while longer. Ask me anything you want to, privately, publicly, anywhere else. I've got no secrets. And where that comes from is not some stroke of righteousness. It comes from addressing these wrongs, you know, addressing these things so that I can be free. I give you one I can't give much of an example. In fact, I won't. Because it takes too long. But it's this thing of what we drag behind. And so when I started, and I had a formidable list of people to whom I owed amends. I had directly been responsible for the lives of two people. I took two human lives. It was unintended. I know that. I'm confident of that. But I did what so many alcoholics have said to me, that you know, my God, I could have done the same thing and might have. Because what I did, driving blind drunk down this main street of the city of Flint, Michigan, ran down and killed two people. And didn't even know it. And when I came to in jail and was greeted with that fact, that was more than I could handle. I mean, I knew that I was capable of anything, but I was not capable of accommodating the information because I'm not a subhuman. You know, I'm not some kind of a depraved person who wants to hurt folk. Never had been. But I was greeted with that, and I just simply couldn't handle it. And I mean, it didn't wig out. I just refused to acknowledge that it was true. But it was obviously true, and gradually it settled in. And so that was something that haunted me, naturally. It was something that haunted me every 24 hours a day. And even in jail, even drunk, long before I got in AA, I knew that I needed to communicate somehow to the families. And there were two families involved. And so I had somebody around town, to contact the families and ask them if they would be willing to hear from me. Both families, very, very understandably, said no. Tell him to leave us alone. Well, you could understand that. So that was not an avenue that I could pursue. And so then, when I was sentenced to the penitentiary, that was omnipresent in my every thought, every day. Understandably. And it was a lot of what made my trying to find hold of something so critically difficult to try to come out, because I was filled with so much shame and guilt and remorse and loathing that I was ashamed to be breathing, never mind looking for help in anything. Excuse me. But when I went in that institution, I was not looking for anything. You know, when I walked in that place, I was absolutely convinced I would never walk out, and didn't care. I mean, I honest to God didn't care, and because I was done. I mean, this thing was done, and so they just filed me away like so much human wreckage, and that's exactly where I had no qualms about being there. That was exactly where I belonged, and I'm confident. Absolutely confident that I would have never come out of that place had it not been for what we're doing here today. And certainly I wasn't looking for anything when I went in there. All I wanted to do, you know, I mentioned isolation. I had got into such isolation that I didn't even communicate with people. You know, the guys on either side of me in sales, I didn't even know who they were. I mean, it wasn't that I didn't care. They didn't exist, you know. I mean, because I was just shut right down. And then when I got the guy that was checking me in, I mentioned earlier about a fellow said you ought to go to AA. And I'd never heard of AA. Had no clue what that was. I'd never even heard of anybody helping a drunk. That was just a foreign language back then. So I wound up in the program and like we've gone up through six, and talking about identifying those things, Yeah, I didn't have to hunt for that. That was just neon in front of me. That was something I had to deal with. Didn't know how to deal with it. But how do you deal with it when you've been responsible for the life of two human beings? There's no way. There was no punishment that would have been adequate to deal with it. Wouldn't matter what. There's not adequate punishment to deal with something that horrendous. And so when I got into AA and started going through the steps, I don't think there was a day of my life that I didn't grapple with how to deal with that. So when I got in AA, you know, heard of amends, I knew that was something that I needed to do. That was something that I had to do. And when the time came, so even before I even got to AA, I was looking for ways that I could try to do something, you know, to try to address that thing. So when I got in and then got to the eighth step, it was pretty obvious that the time had come. And what I did was, with that was obvious. You know, that, and so when I put that on there, you know, it was a matter of just identifying ways that I could possibly try to make amends. I've got a family that doesn't want to hear from me. And they've already sent word, don't contact us. And you can't, it's like the book says, I can't find my relief at somebody else's expense. So I have to honor that. But I was just haunted by the thing and just had to do something. There were two levels of that really required action. One was with the victims themselves. And these were two young folks whose only mistake was trying to cross the street I was driving down by blind drunk. So how do you make amends? What I did was every meeting I attended, and if there was even anything that rhymed with amends, I listened hungrily to anything I could hear. And it might even relate to it and filed away, you know, that anything that I could possibly use. And then when I got to the steps, that was the glaring thing. And there was a limited amount that I could do directly to the victims. And, you know, I put their faces. I'd seen the pictures of them. I'd put their faces directly in front of me. Prayed with their faces there. Tried to communicate. Wrote to them. Did everything I could do in terms of direct action. But obviously, that's limited. And so what I did and have done ever since is we have a thing called indirect amends. When you can't do it personally, directly, can do it indirectly. And so what I did back then is still do to this day. I look for opportunities to do anything that I can possibly do that might make some contribution. Obviously, it's not going to change the reality of that, but it might have some influence on somebody else. And I tell you, it's amazing what happens when you've got the mind and the desire to try to do something. All of the stuff over, now there's no question about it. My zeal in AA is not all just because I'm a dedicated idiot. Some of my zeal is driven by the fact that this is a part of the amends process. You wouldn't believe how many people I have encountered over the years who had direct critical concerns having to do with something like this. You wouldn't believe how many people on every side of the issue that have been really troubled with by something. So they've been a lot of opportunities. And amazing what's happened in terms of things that directly relate to what happened, to trying to make amends. That happened on the 3rd of May of 1956. And I have never, not one single time, deliberately done anything on the 3rd of May in relation to what happened. I've never done anything. I've never planned something to cause amends to come up. But you would be amazed how many things have come up on the 3rd of May that I had absolutely nothing to do with other than agreeing. Spoke to 5,000 young people just about the ages of the ones who were killed on the 3rd of May in two groups of 2,500. Inescapable. Yeah. Made a movie on drunk driving and the hazards of drunk driving 3rd of May. And, you know, it's a strange thing. They did total anonymity. It's this thing I call the Rubik's Cube. You know how they show a face, they put these kind of moving colors, you know. The guy assured me there'd be total anonymity and that they wouldn't try to pay me anything. And disguised the voice. And after that it was done, I've never seen it. I don't know what it is, but there was a woman from North Dakota called me and said, "Tom, have you made a movie?" And I said, "No. What are you talking about?" And it didn't dawn on me what she was talking about. That had been aired on public television, and she said, "I think I saw you in a movie." And I said, "Well, tell me about it." She said, "I said, well, how did you know it was me?" She said, "I recognized your nose." I thought, "Oh my God, yeah, I didn't know it was that bad," but she recognized it. That's anonymity. I don't care whatever you go to, it's going to get through somewhere. But things like that have happened over and over and over again. And so, you know, when I've got a heart to make amends, pray for opportunities, it's amazing how they come up. So even in that's an ongoing process. That's not something that'll ever end. That'll always be an ongoing thing. I was asked when I became an official in the North Carolina prison system, and I was asked to develop a unique organization for young people just about the ages of the victims, something that had never been done in my state. And they asked me to do the development of it. Same age as the victims. And here I had about 700 people that I was able to have some kind of influence in trying to help them shape a future. And so, you know, it's amazing what happens even in indirect amends. That you'll never get through with a thing like that, but it's not an impossible thing. If I'm open and willing and want to make amends, the opportunities come. The families, it were a different matter. Families were the real critical issue, you know, in terms of how to take action. I already had their message that they didn't want to hear. And I respected that. But I did a thing when I did started to do my amends. A-Step says that it made a list of people who harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I don't normally mess with the steps, but I added one word. And I prayed for willingness and opportunity, because I was prohibited from doing anything directly because I can't get my relief at somebody else's expense. And so I did it that way and just resolved myself to the fact that I may not be able to do anything. But I just kind of had a hunch we could. When I was released and went back to North Carolina, I got a phone call one day from an attorney in Michigan whom I didn't know. But he identified himself, and he said there's a hearing, there's going to be a hearing related to the case that you served time for. And he said the families of the people who were killed in that would like for you to come and testify at the trial. And I said, "My God, I'd be willing to do anything I possibly can, but I've got no testimony." You know, the hell of blackouts is that, you know, I sat in the trial and it was as if I were on the jury. I'm listening to the evidence just like everybody else, and no clue. And so I told him, I said, "I've got no testimony. I don't know what I could say." And he says, "Well, they think it would help." and what they had done, you know, what the case was, and you can imagine how a drowning man would jump at a rope. But the case was that what happened was not actually my fault. That what happened was that the young folks had jumped back to avoid another vehicle, jumped into mine. And so instantly, you know, just like you will, I mean, I grabbed at it. I thought, my God, yeah. But then the reality set in. That didn't minimize anything. It didn't mitigate anything. It didn't change one thing. And so I said, okay, I'll do it. And so I went up to Michigan and went into the same courtroom where I was tried. Now, you hurry up and believe that, you know, that making amends takes you in some strange kinds of directions. And so I walked into that courtroom. And it was an electric time. They put me on the stand, and I testified as a guy would do in black eyes. I'm sorry, I just don't know. And I didn't think I contributed much. But amazing thing, you know how they in a court they will stop proceedings and take the attorneys to chambers to go over some legalities or whatever. They took the attorneys in there. Now, I know this is not legal, but apparently God doesn't have the same laws to look at that we do. It's not legal. I know it's not appropriate even, but they put the attorneys in there. They took the families down the hall, both families. And then separately, they took me down the hall, opened the door, and the families were in the room alone. And you know how sometimes... When you just get absolutely shocked beyond belief. Now, I've been praying for opportunity. And when I walked in that door, it was as if a neon bulb went off in the whole world. It was just a bright, bright thing. And I thought, oh, my God. And then the next thought was, well, it looks like your prayers are answered. You know? And it's either step in or run. And I'd have given anything to run. But it can't. So I went in, I went over to the first family and asked them if I could speak with them. And so I talked with them and I said what I wanted to say to them, best I could. And I swear I'll never understand it. They could have not have been more gracious and warm and almost loving. My own family couldn't have been better. And I just couldn't believe it. And so when we finished what we're saying, I went over to the other family, and they were not together. They were in two separate corners. Went over to the other family, and this was an Eastern European people that had just come over. And they were pretty stark people. They were pretty straight people. So I went to the father. That was a protocol. I went to the father and asked him if I could speak. He said, certainly. He listened very courteously. And then when he got through, he said, appreciate your coming. We can't forgive. And please don't bother us again. Well, I wish that it had a different resolution, obviously. But they just couldn't do it. The thing, my heart goes out to that family because they're locked in that. They're locked in it. And they're not free, but they're locked in. The other family is free. And so nothing I can do about that. And I still haven't given up. I never will. But I may never have another opportunity. I accept that. But what the step says is that we try to make direct amends wherever possible. But the caution is we can't impose it on somebody at their expense. So it's a delicate thing. I share that. That's a pretty heavy kind of a thing to deal with. I don't normally do that except unless it is in a setting where we're really looking definitively into this, because it is a little too heavy for the average conference. But there's absolutely nothing in there that I'm not willing to talk about with anybody at any time. I guess the point is that no matter how grievous the harm, this program, the steps, will lead us through it in a way that we can do what we can do to the best of our ability. And that's the great news of that, is that it doesn't change the reality, but it's a way to get through. So I don't care what it is. I don't know of any amend that can't be made, you know, unless it's violating something that somebody has laid down. Otherwise, it's my responsibility to try to do it. I went through that first. It is heavy, but it makes the point, I think, that there is real resolution. What we've got here is a powerful program. This is not just a chat club. This is a powerful program. And no matter what the bondage, no matter what the prison that we're in, there is absolutely no way that we're locked down and can't act. And so that it was an amazing turn of events that was able to get to that point. And it's like I said, it's no secret that a part of it is, you know, that I've got a life. You know, I can't bring back, can't change the history. I can't do anything about that. But what I can do is do something about the way I live, about where I put my energies, about what I try to do, about what I can do to make a difference. And so those opportunities come. And so whatever it is, no matter how grim, there's hope. There's a way to get through. It's a tough situation. I was talking with somebody a little earlier, and I'll just mention this, that the other side of that, the other side of it, the victim side of it, is extremely difficult. I've worked with a guy for a number of years that there was no criminal activity involved, but he had a little boy that got on a toy and drove out into a street. And he was hit and killed by somebody. Well, there was no crime. It was just a tragic accident. Those things happen. And so there was no arrest. There was no crime. But the fella that I've worked with is absolutely consumed with bitterness and hate. I mean, he's consumed. He's imprisoned with that. And I've tried over and over and over to get him to make some move to see if he can't bring some closure to that. And at this point, he's just unable to do it. So it's a tough issue. No matter which side of the table you're on, it's a tough issue. But you know, anyway, enough said. I dealt with that first because it is a tremendous, tremendous hurdle, but I just want to assure you that the program will be adequate. I don't care what it is. Program will be adequate to see you through. Doesn't matter what it is. And the other that I tell you just a couple of things. I wanted to put that in first because I want to make sure I didn't fail to do it if I get caught up. But let me tell you something about amends that I find really useful. And I want to relate back just a little bit to that thing I mentioned with my mother. When I'm working with somebody doing amends, I like to really get to specific detail. And so what I always do in making that list is I want to be real specific. I want to put down the name of the person, place, or thing. Full name. It's exactly who am I talking about. I want to make it as personal as I possibly can. Next thing I want to do is name the wrong. Global guilt has no value. Global guilt. You know, some people want to make sweeping amends, and I believe that global guilt kind of thing doesn't mean anything. That's just sort of a modern deal. So I like to be very specific. Put down the name and exactly what the wrong was, whatever it was. I want to be real clear that I name the wrong, exactly what happened. What did I do? What harm did I do? So I'm real clear and specific about it. And then the third thing is just a logical thing. I like to write that out just to make it right. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. But those are the three things that I like to really get people to put that out in real clear, specific terms. To deal with one amend at a time. So that it's specific, you can address it that way, and take the action. That's the preparation. Then I know what my mission is. And when I go to talk to somebody, I know what to talk about. I know many of you have done it, but it's a tricky process. Yeah. I know what I've found in trying to make amends is that most people don't want to hear it. And I'm not talking about just bitterness but most people find it a very awkward thing and almost invariably every time I go to make amends to somebody, I'd get this thing of sort of embarrassment and not wanting to talk about it. Well, it's important for me to really get clear that the mission is mine. The responsibility is mine. The amend is mine to do. You know, sometimes we read this step as if it said make amends with people we've harmed. It doesn't say that. Says make amends to the people we've harmed. You know, a lot of times, I know that I run into it a lot of times with people where you try to make amends and folks will say, oh, that's okay. Not that big a deal. Just don't do it anymore and keep on doing what you're doing. Well, that's nice, except it has nothing to do with amends. Yeah. It's nice. It just means that we know some nice people, you know, that are generous and forgiving and all that. But it's not about somebody sort of placating me and saying, there, that's all right, big son. The amend is what I carry around. And what somebody else does in terms of forgiveness or not wanting to hear it or say, just keep doing what you're doing, that's fine for them. But it doesn't relieve what's eating me alive. It doesn't relieve what's eating my lunch on a regular basis. Nobody can take that away. And so really important, and I've had to literally almost make people, let me make amends. And sometimes it's fun, sometimes it's not. I know the first one that I ever made when I got out of the institution, for some reason, some bother you more than others. And probably the smallest money that I owed anybody was a guy that, when I got booted out of the military, the guy hired me on the first job, and he was just a wonderful guy. Wonderful man. Warm, loving guy. And I ripped him off for a little bit. It wasn't even a lot. I just kind of jumped down and disappeared. And that one bothered me for some reason. I mean, it was high on my list. It was a fairly minor league thing, but it was not minor league in my life. So, now I know this is not good business, unless your business is making amends. I didn't have any money. I borrowed the money to go make amends. Because I needed to do something. And so I went over there. Now I knew everybody was going to pounce on me. It had been 9 years since I ripped a guy off. So I went over and walked in. Same secretary was there. I remembered her. She didn't remember me. Yeah, I thought sure they were going to say, you scoundrel, you finally came back. That's what I was looking for. And she said, yes, can I help you? I said, well, I'd like to see Mr. Brown. Now, it was Mr. Brown, just like in the book. And I said, I'd like to see Mr. Brown. She said, well, he's pretty busy. I said, well, it's about some money I owe him. And that changed the conversation a little bit. And she said, well, let me see if he can see you. So she went in, and I guess he was curious. He agreed to see me. Walked in, and he was a small man sitting behind a massive desk. And he was a good guy, though. So I went in, and I knew he'd jump on me. He didn't know me. The only guy that was worried about any of this stuff was me. They were all sleeping well, doing great. So I told him, I said, well, sir, you may not remember it, but I ripped you off for some money when I worked here sometime back. He said, is that right? I said, yeah, and I got to pay you back. And I hadn't told him what my mission was about. I just wanted to pay him the money. Yeah, didn't realize that the money was the least important issue. The real issue was that I violated the trust of a good man. So I told him, he said, look, I appreciate your coming, but I can't take that money. I don't need it. And it screw up my bookkeeping. I don't know what to do with it. And I said, well, I'm sorry about your bookkeeping, but I have got to pay you this money. And so finally, I gave up. And I said, well, let me tell you what I'm doing. And so I told him that that was in AA, and a part of our program was try to clear out the wreckage of the past. And I was there to make amends. And it wasn't because I was a good guy. I just needed to get this done. And I said, I need you to take the money. Do whatever you want with it. And he said, well, okay. So he took the money. Now, I don't know what he did with it. I couldn't care less. But right before he took that money, he reached up and took his glasses off, and he said, he was a real righteous man. He said, well, I'll be darned. He said, I've been in business 40 years. I have never had anything like this. And I said, well, me either. But it's, but here we are. And we had a wonderful time. And when I left there, man, I'm telling you, I was barely touching the sidewalk. Just free. Little league deal. But it's not little league when you violate somebody's trust. Money didn't mean that much. And so what I made was not just amends. I made a fast friendship. He's one somebody eats at the same place all the time. And when I'm in Charlotte, where he is, I haven't done it for a few years now, but I go to a restaurant that he frequents. And every time he sees me, he'll always come over and say, how's that work going? That's what he calls it. How's that work going you're doing? I said, just fine. So the amends, amazing that it's not just a matter of getting stuff out. It's getting free. It's about being able to build those relationships back, you know, to make things right. And so enormously, enormously important kind of things. I'm shortchanging that a little bit. Let me deal with one more just right quick, like, because that thing I mentioned with my mother. Yeah, I mentioned earlier when I was talking about that, about the fact that this really interfered with my ability to have relationships. And that was, you know, I became aware of that later on as I was going to start to be aware of that. I was also aware that I needed to make amends to my mother. I was also aware that I was her little baby boy and that she would forgive me for anything. She always had. And when I started to make amends to her, you talk about awkward, fumbling stuff. She didn't want to hear it. She didn't want to hear it. I know one time I was trying to make a little financial amends, and she said, I don't want that money. You don't owe it to me. I said, well, yes, I do. I took it. Well, you know it or not, I took it. And she said, well, you sent me all that money while you were in the Army. I said, what money? Apparently, I got drunk and signed up to send money home and didn't even know it was gone. So she'd get all the money. My first instinct was say, give it back, you know. I didn't say it. I didn't say it, but that was my instinct, you know. And so I had no clue. Even drunk, I'd do a chivalrous act once in a while. But you know, that was a tough thing to do. And so when making amends means to change. And my mother didn't change. She died a mother who just mothered too much, and she was a wonderful person. You couldn't get a better one. It was just more than I could handle. And so when we started to amend our relationship, I didn't negotiate with her. You know, I established the lines that we could operate in. And so when I would go to her house, you know, if I'd let her dictate the thing, I would be staying there a month. But couldn't do that. So I started setting specific times on you, what I would do, how long I'm going to stay, what I'm going to do, and handle it like that. It amended relationship. And we started to get along. Now, I wasn't good at it. I overdid it. I started to make a little bit of money. And sometimes it's trying to make amends, you can make a mess. And so I decided I'd done so much bad stuff, I was going to buy her a home. And I went up to her town, and I didn't bother to ask her if she wanted one. I just knew she would. I hated the place, so I don't know why she wouldn't. And so I just loaded her up, and I said, Mother, let's go look at some property. I didn't tell her what for. I said, go look around town, and you'll see what's happening. So I took her to a whole lot of places. They were building houses, and I'd point out some. And I said, how do you like that? She said, oh, I like it. So I finished my tour, you know, was pointing out houses. She liked them all. Got back home, and I said, well, what did you think of those houses? She said, well, they were nice. I said, is anyone you like particularly? And she said, well, no. And I said, well, I'd like to buy you one. And she said, what for? She said, I don't really want a house. And I said, you mean you don't want a new home? She said, no. Why? She said, I like where I am. Now, that wasn't good enough. You know, I want to make sure I'm going to just not make amends. I'm going to amend her life. And that's not the deal. And so, anyway, that thing, I'll tell you one thing that happened in that, because it's not always smooth sailing. That really, my mother was geared to what she did. That wasn't elected behavior. That's how she was geared. And so when I started to deal, what I was doing was growing up. And for my mother, that was a troubling fact. And as she started to see me emerge as a grown man, she found it very difficult to deal with. And as much as she loved me, in the midst of all of that kind of making amends, one day she looked me in the eye and she said, son, I would rather see you back in prison than like you are. Now that hurts. But she didn't mean that. You know, she was a woman that was dealing with something that she couldn't understand. So she hit with the only thing she knew to hit with. What I had to remember is that I'm the guy with the program. This is my responsibility. I was dealing with somebody who was not equipped for the discussion. And so I had to be patient and not expect some kind of a magical response to that, but to be patient and help her get through that. And so amends often entails more than just, I did this, I'll do this, we're okay. It, more than that, it was a modifying of a relationship. And I'll tell you the thing that I certainly didn't want it, didn't particularly think about it. But a strange thing happens in recovery. It might have happened to some of you. That as we recover and grow in responsibility, amazing thing, I was the embarrassment of my entire family. And I became the head of my entire family. It's not an elected position. It's just something that people kind of deferentially put you there. Now, I didn't want that job. But that's just part of what happens with responsible recovery. Things will tend to happen. And sometimes it's a bad one. So I had to make some calls in that deal. When she started to get some health problems, she started to have some strokes. We realized she was not going to be able to function. We had to put her in a nursing home. My mother had always... It doesn't may not mean anything in Ohio, but my mother had always told my sister and I, don't ever put us in what she called a poorhouse. If you've had to put anybody in a facility, you know it's not the poorhouse. And so she said, no. And so we had the medical conference, and I didn't even know the docs, but they're going around the table, and they're looking, and they happened to settle on me and said, she's going to have to go in a facility, and I think you're the one that's going to have to handle it. Well, I knew that if I told my mother she was going to have to go in the facility, there was going to be a big war going on. So I went into her room, and I chatted for a minute, and I said, Mother, we're going to have to talk about something that you're not going to be able to stay in this facility. We're going to have to put you in a nursing home. And I swear to God, you'd have thought I invited her to a dance. And she said, okay. And I thought, my God, this is, I'm hearing things, you know. I went out in the hall and I said, I conned her. I know I conned her because she's not going to respond like that. I went back in. I said, Mother, let me run this by you one more time because I'm not sure you understood that we're going to have to put you in a nursing home. She said, I know. And I thought, my God, you know, prayers are answered because I really thought it was going to be on.